So this is Michael Nicholson, Reel 27. And we're on the Falklands now.
Are we on the Falklands or on the way to the Falklands?
We're on the way, you know, the Falklands experience.
We're not on the Falklands yet.
No, you've got a long voyage first.
Still a long way to go. Yeah. Well, where do we start? I think we start where I first began the journey, which was not in Portsmouth, but up in the Lake District. I was on holiday with my wife Dinah, my two boys Tom and William, and my dog Zimba, and my little dog Max. And it was routine for us to, this was Ullswater, this was routine for us to organize our walks so that we slowly built up our strength. And on that first morning, it must have been the Sunday, we were walking along the lake for a short walk, and suddenly we were confronted by a herd of cows, one of which was extremely pregnant. And I learnt from my days as an evacuee in the countryside during the Second World War that you don't muck around with a pregnant cow. So I said to Diana, well, let's go back to the hotel and go another way. So we retreated back the way we'd come, to be met by the manager of the hotel racing along, shouting out, oh, the office wants you. The war's begun, the war started. And I thought, what war is this? And of course, and then suddenly I remembered that, when we'd left on the Thursday, Friday, there was this South Georgia invasion, but I never thought much of it. I know ITN had sent Norman Rees to Buenos Aires, but, we couldn't envisage a war against Argentina over the Falklands. So, I said, which war? They said, the Falklands War, the war's begun. So I ran back to the hotel, and just in time, because the office had been trying to contact me. Remember, this is in the days before pagers and mobile telephones. No mobile telephones in 82, maybe 20 years ago, but it's amazing. So they said, oh, thank God you've rung, because, another 5-10 minutes, we'd have sent somebody else. You've got to go to the Falklands with a task force. We've got you a place. Go to Carlisle Airport. And we're sending a plane up to bring you back down to Portsmouth. You're sailing on Monday, Tuesday. I think it was a Monday. Aboard Hermes. Now, what I didn't know at the time, of course, was that... I got to the airport. Diana and the boys continued walking in usual aplomb. And I went to Carlisle Airport and flew in the light aircraft all the way down to Portsmouth, Southampton, Portsmouth, and spent that first night aboard, in barracks there, ready to board the next day, Hermes. A fantastic sight. You imagine everything being loaded up. What I didn't know at the time, of course, there had been an enormous row between the government, or more specifically, Margaret Thatcher, and the Navy about sending the press. There was no intention on the Navy's part to have any member of the press aboard. Now, this was typically Navy, and it still is, despite all the seminars and lectures and teach-ins and conferences and papers and God knows what, which is supposed to improve relationships between the press and the military. Especially the press and the Navy. And I've had experience since, and very little has changed. So the press were not even on the list, let alone a priority. But Maggie, of course, insisted, with her nose for publicity, her nose, I think, to be fair to her too, that people ought to know what's going on. She argued, and it ordered the Navy, ordered Sir John Fieldhouse, who was a cussed old devil who loathed the press, like most of the senior naval officers. She ordered him that he must take the press on board the two aircraft carriers. And even then, they argued it down to the last man, so much so, I think there were only 6 or 8 writing press aboard Invincible. And there was just myself, Brian Hanrahan of the BBC, and a shared crew. They wouldn't even put two crews on board. They'd only let one BBC crew. I think they'd ITN and BBC Tosrit and the BBC One and Bernard Hesketh, who was a great, great, great cameraman. We shared it with the sound man. I mean, later on, the Navy gave in a bit more and sent more press on the following ships on Canberra and the Queen Elizabeth. But that was the contingent that sailed on that. I think it was Tuesday, but I could be wrong. Monday or Tuesday, and off we went. And I remember sailing the Mini Armada, as it was called, sailed out of Southampton docks down past Portsmouth, and I remember the forest of Union Jacks along the quayside and the brass bands. And all the banners and flags waving. That was an astonishing sight.
Would you have reported and filmed that?
We filmed that, yeah. ITN filmed it from the shore, and I think I did some kind of radio piece from the ship. Great forest of Union Jacks. And I remember I was on the poop deck, which is the one of the upper decks of Hermes, and I was standing alongside a young Lieutenant Commander Rupert Nicol, he kind of nudged me and he said, I feel a bit of a cheat, don't you? I said, yes, I do. Because we were convinced, all of us at that time, that, you know, we'd be back in a week. You know, we probably wouldn't get further than the Scilly Isles. Before, you know, diplomacy won, the Argentinians retreated and went back home and, you know, no longer the threat of war. So we felt a bit of a cheat. None of us could have believed that we were on our way to war. The other interesting thing was that I learned much later that I mentioned the Scillies there because as we passed the Scillies, and I learned this much, much later after the war had ended, from a signals officer, that Hermes, Captain Hermes, Lynn Middleton, who oddly enough only lives down the road from here, 300 or 400 yards away, Lynn received a message, and it simply had one word on it, diet, D-I-E-T, diet. And that, translated from the code, was starve the press. So even while we were still in English waters, British waters, Fieldhouse from Northwood instructed the flagship officer that we should be starved of information. So that was the kind of atmosphere in which we sailed. Now, there wasn't a great deal to report, of course, on the way down, and it took 6 weeks, remember. The reason for that, and it wasn't published at the time, was that Invincible kept breaking down. Now, she was the much newer ship. Hermes was an old ship, you know, it's an old Second World War, you know, cast iron bucket, and she was rusting like mad. I mean, I think Tony Carthew, the ITN reporter at the time who saw the Armada sail out, described her as an old rusting bucket which upset the Navy no end. But she'd just come back from service, was ready for a repaint, of course, was off again. But she was a solid ship. I mean, we loved her. We felt totally safe in her because she was so thick and, you know, solid. Whereas Invincible was made of tissue paper, and it kept breaking down. Gearbox kept failing. We didn't know this, of course, because at sea you don't know where you are, nobody tells you. But we were held up for a long time off the West African coast, which enabled us to get our first and only film report off to the British Embassy. I think it was off in Sierra Leone they were sent. But a new gearbox or an engineer's or in plus gearbox spare parts were sent out from London so that the Invincible could be repaired. So the Armada was delayed and delayed and delayed because of Invincible. And I remember later learnt the story that the Captain Black, who was the commanding officer, was the captain of Invincible, went down to the engineers in this huge engine room, and powered by a jet engine, by the way. So, you know, amazing to think a ship that size is powered by a single jet engine, but it was. And he said to you, if you can get this gearbox going, you'll get a crate of champagne. And sure enough, they got it going eventually, and he did take him a crate of champagne. We crossed the equator and the usual frolicking. Prince Andrew, of course, was on board Invincible. He was in a helicopter. Was it? No, he wasn't. I beg your pardon. I forget which one he was on board. Was it Brilliant or Broadsword? He was a Lynx helicopter pilot. And he joined in all the frolicking, you know, the dipping as you cross the equator. It was a very uneventful journey south. The problem was, of course, for us, is that London, ITN, BBC, and presumably the British public, were all, you know, desperate, gasping for news. I mean, it was the biggest running story of all time, and every news bulletin probably led with it. But there was nothing we could supply them. You know, there was nothing happening, 6 weeks of nothingness. And things only began to gel for us when we learnt that the diplomatic to-ing and fro-ing by, was it Costa Mendes and General Haig, Alexander Haig, they were the kind of go-betweens. Well, he was the go-between. And the Argentinians, of course, were playing this delaying game. The reason being, you see, is that we sailed in April, and remember, we're in the southern hemisphere, so we're sailing into winter. Winter would be kind of July, and winter in the Falklands, especially winter in the Roaring Forties, was a pretty horrific prospect, and that's why the Argentinians kept delaying in the hope that we would realize that. Just hold on. Yes, that was the idea, that they would delay and delay so that it would deter us from beginning our offensive in midwinter. Thankfully, their bluff was called, and we arrived there before winter began, and certainly crossed the Roaring Forties before it got too bad. Now, we entered the total exclusion zone, and I remember there was an order that all beards should be shaved off, which upset a great many warrant officers and chief petty officers who'd had beards all their naval life. Brian Hanrahan, who was the BBC cameraman, had a beard. We'd all had our photographs taken, of course, before we left for security reasons. We had this chain around our neck with our blood group, an identity number, and a photograph. And everyone had their beer shade off because of the fear of gas attack. And the masks wouldn't fit a bearded face. I tell you this because a little time later, when we were just about to go ashore at San Carlos Water, the security officer came round to check we had all our proper gear on, excuse me, and check our identity discs and so on. And he looked at Brian Hanrahan's photograph, the bearded Brian Hanrahan, and then looked at Brian Hanrahan for real, the non-bearded Hanrahan, and he said, and he meant it, he said, "I'm sorry, sir, you can't go ashore. Your face is invalid." Brian doesn't have much of a sense of humour either, but even he laughed. So, total exclusion zone, the 200-mile limit around the Falklands, which was ours. That was our territorial waters. If the Argentinians came within it, they would be attacked, sunk, whatever. Now, the very first, as I remember it, the very first air attack by us on the Argentinians was on May the 1st. They were, of course, by this time well ensconced on the Falkland Islands. They controlled the airstrip, and our Harriers took off, I think, if you check, it'll be May the 1st, the very first Harrier attack. And it was very successful. We were dropping these cluster bombs. We had no casualties on that day. I think the first casualty came a few days later when one of the Harrier pilots was shot down. And of course, that the very first attack, he was immortalized, Brian Hanrahan, because he came up with that wonderful line, You know, I can't, we weren't allowed to say how many aircraft had taken part, but he circumvented that by saying, I counted them out and I counted them all back again. Now, I'm told, I mean, I kick myself because I kick myself for not thinking of it myself, because it's one of the phrases that came out of that war. But I gather Rupert Nicholl, and I don't know whether he confirmed this, but when he saw the aircraft take off from the bridge, it reminded him of a wartime movie, a British wartime black and white movie. You know, the Lancasters are all coming back from a bombing raid over Berlin, and the air traffic controller says, I've counted them out and I've counted them back again. And he said that within hearing distance of Brian, and Brian thought, that is a fantastic phrase, and use it. Now, that is legend. Whether it's true or not, anecdotal, I don't know. But I kicked myself for not thinking of it myself. Anyway, sidestepping that, suddenly we were at war. We'd sent our first aircraft off to attack. We sent aircraft off to intercept the Argentinian aircraft on their way from their bases in Argentina. One unusual thing happened. The chief, the leading Harrier pilot, the squadron leader, if you like, of the Harriers aboard Hermes, I shan't mention his name. You can check it out and insert it if you wish. But he was the top gun, if you like. He was the top Harrier pilot. He went off, so the story goes, and I've heard it many times from various pilots, and attacked Etondar, I think it was. And, you know, one of the great... The war was probably won by the Harriers. I think it's generally conceded that the war was, if we hadn't had the Harriers, we'd have been stuck. They had this wonderful ability of, not only were they fast, not only could they take off vertically, but they could, not stop in midair, but they could de-accelerate so fast that, you know, it was easy for an attacking aircraft behind you to simply overshoot you. And that's what they did. The aircraft would overshoot the Harrier, and the Harrier would then let loose off their sidewinder missiles. And this is what this guy did. And he saw, as it was described, he saw the plane pass him, and he saw the pilot, obviously not his face because you're covered in masks, but he saw the pilot, and then he loosed off his sidewinder, and then he went up the back side of the plane straight into the engine and blew it up. So he had, you know, and he didn't recover from that. When he got back to Hermes, he decided that he wouldn't do any more killing. A lot of excuses were made. I think he was supposed to have suffered from claustrophobia or some kind, but he was sent home. Now, that was never known. We didn't know about it. We'd simply been told he'd been transferred to another ship. But it's one of those extraordinary things that happened to men in war. I mean, I at the time, and I still do feel angry about it, that we spend all these millions of pounds training pilots. It does cost millions. And the planes themselves cost many, many millions. And their one purpose in training these men is that they will be killers at our orders, the orders of the government, orders of their superior officers. And this man, at the time when he was most needed, funked it and decided he couldn't take it. And just tangentially, I did a series of radio interviews with people on the Falklands and of the Falklands. And I interviewed the top gun pilot, David Morgan. He had four kills. And a very jovial guy at the time, I remember, very gung-ho, very kind of Battle of Britain pilotish, you know. But I met him all these years on, 20 years on, and he's a very melancholy guy, very, very melancholy about what he did. And I think almost regrets what he did. It's odd, you know, they have this image of these guys of being, daredevils, and, you know, and yet when they kill, it rests heavily on them. Having never killed, I can't empathize, but it's always astonished me. Anyway, I've been rather diverting there. Our first casualty, of course, as we know, was the Belgrano. A lot's been said about Belgrano, about whether it should or shouldn't have been sunk, whether it was a menace or not. And I suppose the debate would go on for many years. All I know is that she was a threat to us. A bigger threat was the Argentinian aircraft carrier, I think it was called May 25th, which of course would be carrying its own aircraft and could get very close to us. Thirdly, I interviewed Sandy Woodward, and he said, and it's on camera, there is a cruiser irritating us. I shall give it a bloody nose. And that was 3 days before he gave the order, or Fieldhouse gave the order, for Conqueror to sink the Belgrano. The fact that she may not have been facing this is beside the point. The fact is she was inside the 200-mile limit, okay, supposedly on her way out of it. But she was where she shouldn't have been. She was a threat to us, and she was sunk. Now, the important thing for me is that having sunk her, the aircraft carrier, May 25th, turned around and went back to port and didn't leave port again. Now, to my mind, that vindicates any action that was taken in the Belgrano. That's my personal opinion. And when you're at sea, you feel very vulnerable. And the fewer the threats, the better. Of course, the Argentinians had their revenge very quickly, because I think it was only about 4 days later Shepherd was hit.
About the Belgrano, what did you know at the time, and what could you report?
We learned very quickly that she had been hit and sunk. And we were told of the casualties. We were told that the two picket ships that were alongside her did not pick up survivors, but scuppered as quickly as they could. Now, I don't know whether that's true or not, but that's what we were told, and that's what's been reported in history books since. We were allowed to broadcast the fact, but I think the British public knew before we did. Quite often, as it turned out, the Ministry of Defence issued through Ian MacDonald, the MOD spokesman, news of events quicker than we were allowed to broadcast them. I think it was, you know, kind of the kind of spiteful way that the MOD thought there'd always be one step ahead of the press in the field. You know, they knew best, and they were in charge. So quite often our reports were deliberately delayed so that the MOD spokesman could get the first line in. Anyway, we did report it. I remember a line I used at the time is that there was, just ad-libbing it, but I remember saying something along the lines that, you know, we've heard the news, but no sailor aboard our ship is celebrating. Sailors do not celebrate, do not rejoice in the death of other seamen, whoever they are, or whatever they are. And it's true, the ship was silent. There was no cheering. I think it was the Sun newspaper who invented some lines along the fact that they were cheering aboard Invincible. I don't believe it. There was no cheering aboard Hermes. So, the Sheffield, we saw the plume of smoke. She was some distance from us, some miles. And of course, she sacrificed herself for us. That Exocet missile was on its way to us. I mean, the aircraft weren't firing to knock out a destroyer or a frigate. They were there to knock out the aircraft carriers. And you know what a picket ship is? They call it a goalkeeper. Each carrier is surrounded by a number of ships to look after it, from other ships, but most especially from the air, either from aircraft or from missiles. And so they're the kind of ships on your perimeter protecting you. And though that missile was meant for us, it hit the first picket ship, which was Sheffield. I mean, there's been an awful lot of discussion since whether Sheffield's radar and was working properly, whether the computers were working properly, you know, why they didn't sight it coming. Because it comes very fast and very low. I don't think that, I mean, I've never, I've read endlessly about why Sheffield went down. The fact is, if she hadn't been hit, we would have been hit. You must remember also, and I know this from Lynn Middleton, the captain of Hermes, that we say, well, thank God, you know, if it hadn't been Sheffield, it would have been us and we'd have gone down. He says, nonsense. There was no way an exocet or even four exocets could have sunk Hermes. But nevertheless, it would probably put us out of action for a long time. So the men did not die in vain. Again, you know, Navy, we were not allowed to report the name of Sheffield. We simply said the ship had been hit. We do not know the extent of casualties. Now, had we been allowed, you imagine, I don't know how many frigates there were, how many destroyers there were there, I forget. But instead of saying, allowing us to say that this HMS Sheffield had been hit, so that only the families of Sheffield could worry, to say that a ship or a frigate or a destroyer, and there may have been half a dozen frigates, half, every member of every family of every one of those ships were worrying. And it seemed to me terribly cruel to have done it that way. We weren't even allowed to film Sheffield until 4 days afterwards, and only then, because Sandy Woodward wanted pictures of the ship himself, because she took about 4 or 5 days to sink. She only sank when she was being towed. They're very restrictive, very, very restrictive. I have only, I say, bitter memories, unhappy memories of our relationship with the Royal Navy during those days. I remember Bernard Hesketh, who had been an officer in the Second World War, artillery officer, hearing a senior naval officer aboard Hermes accuse us of being good enough as being spies for the Argentinians. And he drew back his trouser leg and showed a scar up his leg and said, I got that on the beaches of Normandy. Don't you ever call me a spy. Still running?
Did you see any of the wounded or
ill? Yes, the wounded, the injured of Hermes Sheffield, came aboard Hermes, and we did film them. One astonishing one: the guy was almost walking himself. He was being helped, but you could see that he didn't seem to be badly injured. And then only an hour or so later, we heard that he died. And it turned out that, you know, it was the fire and the smoke that killed most of them on Sheffield. And it turned out that when they tried to take off his clothes, it took all the skin away too. Because you see, the typical penny pinching for cheapness, the Navy had done away, or the Ministry of Defence, I suppose, is to blame, did away with the old-fashioned cotton socks and cotton shirts and cotton trousers. And instead, these men had to wear polyesters, nylon. Of course, when that catches fire, or when in the heat, it melts, and it melted to the skin. And so many of the most dreadful injuries were caused because of that.